KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, with dramatic increases in both type 1 and especially type 2 diabetes reported recently by the Centers for Disease Control, we'll discuss epidemiology, prevention, causes, and medications for diabetes with a panel of experts. California has the highest number of new diabetes cases, and Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. According to a new and recently released study by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, type 2 diabetes cases nearly doubled over the past decade. Some 26.3 million people, or 7.8% of the population, have diabetes, and an estimated 5.7 million remain undiagnosed. In 2006, diabetes was the nation's seventh leading cause of death, and a quarter of all U.S. adults have what is medically diagnosed as prediabetes. The study by the CDC focused on 33 states, and the highest number of new diabetes cases turned out to be right here in California. In 2007, estimated costs, both direct and indirect, for diabetes reached $174 billion. This forum hour, we turn our attention to diabetes and prediabetes and what these new statistics mean. And joining us from Atlanta is Ed Gregg, who is chief of epidemiology with the CDC's Division of Diabetes Translation. And good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Glad to have you here. And here with us in studio is Hillary Seligman, who is assistant professor of medicine at UCSF, San Francisco General Hospital. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Karen Earle also joins us in studio. She's medical director of the Center for Diabetes Services with the California Pacific Medical Center, also chief of the Division of Endocrinology with the CPMC, and president of the San Francisco American Diabetes Association, as well as assistant professor with the faculty at UCSF. And welcome, Karen Earle.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Glad to have you all here. Let me go first to Atlanta and to Ed Gregg. And, let's talk first about what really is responsible, as far as we know, for this huge jump.
Well, first of all, it's important to point out that this is an increase in incidence of people who have been diagnosed with diabetes, which is in part a function of detection. And so we do have to keep in mind that increased awareness about diabetes is fueling part of this. But we don't think that that explains all of this. And half or more of this, we really do think, is due to an increase in the rate at which people are developing diabetes in the U.S. and California.
Well, it's also obesity, isn't it, and other risk factors, more sedentary lives?
Right. Well, that's even underlying that, of course. When we see these trends in diabetes, we see over and over again that they really do parallel the trends in obesity in the population, particularly trends in severe obesity.
And the second most important factor is age. I mean, people are living longer, so they're more apt to get diabetes. As we get older, I guess we produce less insulin, don't we?
That's true as well. Age is not as commonly recognized as a risk factor, but it really is fairly equivalent to body weight as a risk factor for diabetes. And particularly when we look at trends in prevalence or the proportion of the population overall who has diabetes, we really see that influences that prevalence, because as people are living longer and longer due to better medical care on the whole, then this actually increases the rate at which people are entering the population with diabetes and staying alive longer and longer with that condition.
And speaking of age, type 1, which is more apt in many cases to afflict younger people, has also gone up fairly strongly. Not as much as 2, but it has also gone up considerably, has it not?
Well, there is evidence that type 1 diabetes has gone up as well, but when we look at the trends in the U.S. overall, since type 2 proportionally takes such a much greater proportion of overall cases, that the increases in the U.S. really are fueled by our problems with type 2 diabetes.
We're talking to Ed Gregg, who is Chief of Epidemiology with the Center for Disease Control's Division of Diabetes Translation. And this is a state-by-state study, we should add. And I think, Ed Gregg, I'm correct in saying that this is the first time a state-by-state study was done. We discovered, as a result of the study, that California has had more cases than any other state. What accounts for that? Do you know?
Well, we don't know for sure why California was the leader in this way. As I mentioned before, since awareness and detection influences the rate of incidence, that it's possible that California has more better awareness and more detection going on. But it's also possible that some of the negative or bad things underlying these are also occurring in California. The trends in obesity, shifts in the diet. But the other thing that can factor in here is that if there are demographic shifts in the population of particularly high-risk groups, such as non-whites, Latinos, and African Americans have an increased risk as well. So if there are shifts in demographics, that can influence rates to some degree.
Well, there are more. There's more diabetes as well as pre-diabetes, we should mention, in African Americans, but also in Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, as well as the aged. I mean, it cuts across just about every ethnic line.
That's right. And California's diversity is probably a contributor to that.
Let me just ask you something else about the regions, because I was struck by the dramatic difference. There was a low of 5 per 1,000, for example, diabetes cases in Minnesota as compared to almost 13, 12.7 per 1,000 in West Virginia, which also has the highest rates of obesity. But that's pretty striking.
It really is, and it reflects the diverse set of factors that influence diabetes. We've mentioned age, we've mentioned obesity, but poverty and aspects of culture affecting what we eat and how active we are play a huge role as well. So when you see, even though the increases in California have been highlighted in this study, when we look nationally and we look at the diabetes maps, we see that the Deep South, West Virginia, the Mississippi Valley areas are really, and particularly in Native areas where Native Americans are around the country, are areas of particularly high risk.
Ed Gregg, again with us from Atlanta, Chief of Epidemiology with the Centers for Disease Control's Division of Diabetes Translation. And Hillary Seligman is Assistant Professor of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and at San Francisco General Hospital. And Dr. Seligman, I was looking at a study where the risk of diabetes was cut by well over 50% in a three-year period by just losing 5 to 10% of weight and by exercising for 30 minutes 5 days. I mean, the writing's on the wall in terms of prevention.
Yeah, that's really the key point here, is that the true answer to prediabetes is really in diet and exercise. There have been some very well done studies which have shown that the most potent way to reduce your progression from prediabetes to diabetes is to lose weight, to go on a low-fat, low-calorie diet, and to increase your physical activity level.
Let's talk about the differences with you about prediabetes and diabetes, because there's a lot of concern about, you know, where do I cross the Rubicon, and the numbers have kind of been jiggered a bit through the years. What can you tell us in general about what distinguishes, say, a prediabetic from someone who's crossed the threshold into diabetes?
Mm-hmm. Most people will screen patients for diabetes using what's called a fasting blood sugar. That's a blood test that's done before breakfast in the morning, so after you've had a fast of at least 8 hours. If your blood level is greater than 125, we call that diabetes. If your blood level is between 100 and 125, we call that prediabetes. The reason we call that prediabetes is that some of the risk that you get from having a diagnosis of diabetes actually begins to occur even when your blood sugar is a little bit lower than the cutoff for diabetes, which is 126 or above. So, for example, your risk of a heart attack or a stroke actually may go up at the prediabetes level, and that's why it's important to intervene at the prediabetes level to prevent progression to diabetes and to use it as sort of a wake-up call that you need to start instituting some diet and exercise changes to prevent future risk.
How do people know if they're at risk? I mean, if they should be tested in general?
There are a number of risk factors, some of which that you have mentioned already. Number one would be obesity. If you're overweight, if you're obese, and if you're elderly, these are two very key risk factors for prediabetes and diabetes. The other risk factors have to do with what other medical conditions you have. If you have high blood pressure, if you have high triglycerides or high cholesterol in general, if you're a woman and you've had a baby that was over 9 pounds, that's a risk factor for developing diabetes. You should be screened regularly for the development of diabetes. These are all things that occur very commonly in the population and should prompt people to ask their physician to be screened for diabetes about every 3 years.
The thing that a lot of people don't realize also is just how you can live with diabetes. I'm living proof of that. I mean, just take your blood sugar and, you know, you change your diet. But you need to really get on the stick as soon as you find out that you are pre-diabetic, particularly because of the risks that are involved. I mean, it increases the likelihood or possibility of stroke, of heart disease, of retina problems. I mean, there are just so many things that can befall you when you're diabetic.
Yes. The risks associated with diabetes are huge. And for any person diagnosed with diabetes, it needs to be a real life-changing diagnosis. The risks of heart attack and stroke are markedly increased. But in addition, people are at much higher risk of amputation, of going blind, and from having kidney failure. These are the key risks of people with diabetes. And what really needs to drive people to make lifestyle changes before the diagnosis of diabetes, because we can prevent the development of these things at the pre-diabetes stage through lifestyle changes.
Let me go to Karen Earle, who's also with us in studio, Medical Director of the Center for Diabetes Services with the CPMC, the California Pacific Medical Center. And Dr. Earle, a lot of new drugs on the market, and it seems to be a division between old drugs and new drugs with diabetes, which also can be confusing to people who have diabetes.
Absolutely. So there's been some drugs for diabetes that have been around for, you know, 20-plus years, and they're still the staples of care for most patients with diabetes, in addition to the lifestyle interventions that we've already mentioned. But within the last couple of years, we've seen some exciting new drugs sort of hit the market. One big problem with these new drugs is they tend to be expensive. So these are new drugs. They're being marketed by the pharmaceutical industry, and they tend to be much more expensive than the old standard drugs. But they offer some really exciting benefits over some of the older drugs. I don't think they're going to replace the standards of care, which include a drug called metformin and a class called the sulfonylureas. Those are still really standards of care for diabetics. But particularly for patients that can't tolerate those medications, it's really exciting to have some new options for our patients.
Well, in fact, you're talking about the cost. Prescription diabetes drug costs nearly doubled from 2001 to 2007. There's a study done, in fact, out of Stanford and I believe University of Chicago. So it's getting a lot more expensive to have diabetes.
It's a lot more expensive to have diabetes. And a lot of these new drugs cost $150 to $200 per month to continue on these medications. And presumably, these are medications you're going to be taking long term. So it definitely adds up. I'd like to mention, though, that the biggest cost in diabetes really is the treatment of the complications. So when we talk about the overall expenditure, you mentioned a big number in the billions. Certainly, some of that is going into diabetes medications, but a lot of it's going to patients that don't manage their diabetes as well as we might like and then suffer some of the complications. So the eye disease, kidney disease, nerve disease, strokes, heart attacks, those are all very, very expensive as well.
A lot of side effects, particularly with many of these new drugs?
There are some side effects with the new medications, depending on which one we're talking about. One of the most common ones, exenatide, has some GI side effects. There's certainly been a controversy about another class of medications, the thiazolidinediones, and potential risk with heart disease in those medications.
Speaking of heart disease, when you find out you have diabetes, you need to treat high blood pressure or cholesterol because of the relationship between heart disease and the link to diabetes.
Right. No, they're all really important, and particularly preventing heart disease. We have much stricter standards for blood pressure control and lipid or cholesterol control in patients with diabetes.
And what about the sense of these new drugs being alternatives to insulin? That's mainly, I guess, the push with them, isn't it?
Somewhat. I mean, I still think insulin is a fabulous medication for diabetes. And so I hate to say that we want to delay insulin initiation in patients because insulin actually really corrects the inherent problem in diabetes, which is lack of insulin. So I love using insulin in my patients. But some patients have a negative connotation with insulin or they have a fear of the injections. And so they prefer to try some other medications before starting on insulin.
There are higher risk for low blood sugar because of insulin?
Yes, but actually a lot of the medications can cause low blood sugars too. So some of the classes of medications, particularly the sulfonylureas, one of the older classes, has a very similar risk for low blood sugar as does insulin.
And if I can go back to you, Karen Earle, on blood sugar in general, mm-hmm. I mean, again, these numbers seem to be kind of moving around or certainly have over the last few years. What's behind that?
So the numbers for diagnosis of diabetes, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there has been a change, and I can't remember exactly when the change occurred, but we're getting more stricter with our criteria for both prediabetes and diabetes. So we mentioned the 126 fasting blood sugar cutoff, and at some point it used to be 140, and at some point we couldn't even test that accurately, and it was even higher than that before someone would start manifesting symptoms of the disease.
And Hillary Seligman, I guess we're just talking about cost now for the moment. It's safe to say that so-called lifestyle intervention is more cost-effective than medications.
Certainly, a lot of the cost of lifestyle intervention is borne by the patient, and that's true. Now, in the studies that are done, the patients who do a lot of work to achieve the goals in diet and physical activity are often enrolled in very intensive lifestyle modification programs where they meet very frequently with a nutritionist and they do structured exercise routines, sometimes weekly, sometimes more often. And so often in the studies, the cost effectiveness is not clear. For an individual patient, though, it is clearly easier, more cost-effective if you pay for your own medications to institute lifestyle and, diet and exercise changes.
Ed Gregg, is the CDC making specific recommendations as far as so-called lifestyle changes?
Yes, and in terms of, well, first of all, they're basically consistent with what we've been talking about during this hour. People that are have been identified with as being at high risk or having prediabetes, clearly those people are going to benefit if they can get into structured programs or, for that matter, if they're effective at doing it on their own to increase their levels of physical activity, lose weight in a modest way, undertake a healthier diet, basically, they're going to really reduce their risk of developing, of converting to diabetes or developing diabetes in the near future.
And do we know generally about, I had sort of gone over some statistics in the beginning of the program about all of the people, considerable number of people who have no idea that they have diabetes. How do we get a crack at those numbers?
Well, we actually, in some of the national surveys, we're able to measure that proportion of the population with diabetes who don't know it. It ends up being about 3% or about 30% out of all the people who have diabetes don't know it. So that area is a concern because if those people can be detected efficiently, then there are certainly a lot of treatments and interventions that can really reduce the risk of complications. But our newer area of concern really is the proportion of people who have prediabetes who don't know it. Although about a quarter of the population are at risk, there's actually a report that came out just this Friday that showed us that only about 4% of those who have prediabetes have been told that. So that's really a new challenge for us.
It's also a challenge, it strikes me, in telling people, again, with prediabetes, exhorting them, really, as best medicos can do that, to get their act together.
Well, I think part of that is there is something to the knowledge of risk and that does motivate people. But I think that we also have to look beyond that and understand that that what our communities have for people in terms of programs or in terms of availability of good places to exercise, of availability of different healthy foods and access to those things, that is a crucial level of support that has to be there as well.
Well, there has to be education, particularly in terms of diet. A lot of people just don't know what's not good for them.
Certainly. education's got to be there, and then also the access to the types of foods that to allow people to really act on that.
Again, Ed Gregg is Chief of Epidemiology with the Center for Disease Control's Division of Diabetes Translation, and Karen Earle is Chief of the Division of Endocrinology and at CPMC at the California Pacific Medical Center. Let's get back to drugs for a minute, if we could, with you, Karen Earle. And again, it's not clear if these newer drugs actually improve patient care and results, according to the research of this study that I referenced before out of Stanford University of Chicago.
Right.
So how long do we need to before we can actually know that they have the kind of efficacy that we hope they do?
Yeah, it's a great question, but hard to answer because, you know, the data on potential risk for the thiazolidinediones didn't come out until 7 years after they were released. And so really, I think one of the biggest concerns are long-term safety side effects of the newer medications. And so to be approved by the FDA, you have to meet a certain set of criteria, but we won't know the long-term safety until these drugs have really been on the market. And I'd say 5, 10, 20 years before we really know long-term safety. I mention again that diabetes is a chronic condition, and these are medications that people will be using long-term. And so long-term safety is really a big concern with the newer medications.
We're going to be doing a show down the line here again, updating stem cells. But a lot of hope as far as research there, isn't there?
There's some excitement about the idea of stem cells in diabetes. I think we're still quite a ways away. So I encourage anyone who has diabetes to hope for the future, but, you know, live in the now and make sure they get good control of their diabetes with what is currently available.
Well, again, full disclosure, I'm a diabetic now, and one of the things I learned about my diabetes, Hillary Seligman, is I'm in a minority. 15% of us are skinny, and it's a different ball game, so to speak, for those of us who are thinner.
That's true. You are in the minority for people who are diagnosed with diabetes in 2008. Most people are overweight or obese. But in truth, the treatment is very similar for people who are overweight and people who are not overweight, and that is attention to diet and exercise. The same, once you have diabetes, the same low-carbohydrate diet is effective for people whether they're overweight or not overweight. And before the development of diabetes, the real challenge for people is to adhere to a low-fat diet, whether that is has a component of weight loss to it, like it needs to for people who are overweight and obese, or for people who are not overweight and who don't need to necessarily be on a low-calorie diet. They just need to reduce their fat intake.
Well, I think I mentioned it before we went in the air. Jacques Pepin was on last week, and I said, boy, you know, being diabetic, can't only eat whole grain bread and can't eat potatoes and don't have desserts anymore and very little wine. He said, that would kill me.
Yeah.
But you also learn in terms of, and people ought to know this, I mean, you've got to monitor your blood sugar pretty regularly. And then there's kind of what they think of as the batting average, the A1C, the hemoglobin test.
Right. I'm glad you bring that up because a lot of patients with diabetes don't know what the hemoglobin A1C is, and it's a really useful way to track your blood sugar. So a hemoglobin A1C is a blood test that's done about every 3 to 6 months for patients with diabetes, not for prediabetes. And it gives the physician and the patient, too, a value that represents about what your average blood sugar has been over the previous 3 months. And this is a way of taking sort of a long-range view of what your blood sugar has been and how aggressive you need to be in bringing your blood sugar under further control. This is very different than the day-to-day blood sugar checks that a lot of patients with diabetes do, particularly patients who are on insulin who check their blood sugar once a day, twice a day, three times a day, sometimes even more often. The goal in those blood checks is to make immediate compensation for what your blood sugar is. If your blood sugar is too low, you need to get yourself more blood sugar in your body. If it's too high, you need to take more medicine or take a walk around the block or reduce the carbohydrates in your next meal.
And the advice of your humble interlocutor here is if you have hereditary disposition or diabetes in your family, by all means get checked. Fast and get checked right away. That happened to be my problem in part, great part. You can join us if you have questions or comments. Our hour is all about diabetes prevention and treatment and medications and the rising and staggering rising numbers, particularly here in California more than other states. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The rate of new cases of type 2 diabetes has nearly doubled in the United States over the last decade, according to a new study by the Centers for Disease Control. And we're looking at the reasons for the increase and finding out about new treatment and prevention methods, and talking also about prediabetes. With us in studio is Karen Earle. She's medical director of the Center for Diabetes Services with the California Pacific Medical Center and president of the San Francisco American Diabetes Association. And Hillary Seligman is assistant professor of medicine at UCSF, San Francisco General Hospital. And I should mention Karen Earle is also assistant professor and on the faculty at UCSF. And Ed Gregg is with us from Atlanta. He's chief of epidemiology with the CDC's Division of Diabetes Translation. And let us go right to your calls here, and we'll go first to you, Matt. Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Having sold metformin products in the diabetes marketplace from a pharmaceutical company, I think it's disingenuous for your guests to be giving advice to diabetics saying, you know, eat low carbs, but also eat low fat. Diabetes is largely a disorder of glucose and that your body isn't utilizing it. And if you don't eat fatty foods, how are you supposed to gain the proteins that you need? And ultimately saying any carbohydrates are going to make your diabetes much, much worse, and that the Atkins diet really is the best diet for diabetics. In particular, if you speak with endocrinologists like I have, they'll tell you they can control type 2 diabetes just by diet alone and exercise.
I think your point is well taken. In that you need the protein, obviously, and you need the carbs. Hillary Seligman, I don't think you were suggesting that you avoid those. You just have to have a balanced diet of those. Right?
That's true. A low-fat diet, it would be most important for patients with prediabetes, because the goal, particularly in obese and overweight patients with prediabetes, is weight loss. Once you have a diagnosis of diabetes, your caller is absolutely right. The focus needs to be on reducing carbohydrates in the diet. And I want to also...
Even more than sugar in some instances. I mean, carbs are really vital here.
Carbs are very vital here. I want to...
bad carbs as opposed to good carbs.
Yes. Yes, that's true. I do want to emphasize that when you're talking about a low-carb diet or you're talking about a low-fat diet, this does not mean the exclusion of these of proteins and fat from your diet. This just means a reduction in the percentage of your calories that come from fats or from carbohydrates. So, you know, the bottom line is low-carbohydrate diet is extremely important for patients with diabetes. Low-fat diet, particularly if it leads to weight loss, is extremely important for pre-diabetics.
Do you want to add anything here, Karen Earle?
I would just add that, you know, the caller mentioned the Atkins diet, and I do have some reservations about diets that severely restrict carbohydrate intake, because as we mentioned, there's good carbs and bad carbs. And actually, there's some, you know, whole grains that are really important, offer a lot of nutritional value, and I'd hate to see patients think that they have to avoid all carbohydrate intake.
Vegetables are, in fact, very good for you, obviously.
Vegetables, fruits, lots of carbohydrates that we do encourage patients eat in more limited quantities with diabetes.
Marcia is our next caller. Good morning, Marcia.
Good morning. So my question is, I have a brother. He's 51 years old. He's diabetic. He was diagnosed at around 30. He's insulin dependent. He takes really good care of it. He monitors all day long. My question is, and he's not overweight. My question is, he drinks kind of every day 2 or 3 glasses of red wine, and I'd like to know how you feel about that, and I'm going to take my answer off the air.
Okay, and he's not French, I presume, right?
Sorry?
monitoring all day long is probably a little over the top, isn't it? You don't need to do that, really, do you?
It depends. He's on insulin, so when someone's on insulin, they do have to monitor more frequently. So generally, my patients on multiple injections of insulin a day are measuring at least 4 times, some of them up to 10 times a day.
Wow. And what about the wine?
You know, wine is a tricky thing, because wine can actually, you know, wine does have some carbohydrate in it, but actually in most instances it can lower blood sugar. So particularly people who are at risk for low blood sugar, like patients on insulin, they do have to be careful with the wine. You know, I never tell my patients they absolutely can't drink wine, because I think that is hard for a lot of people to hear. But I usually suggest they try to limit it to 1 glass at a time.
Mitch, you're next up. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I have a lot of people asking me, you know, if I used to be obese or why I don't exercise. So I wonder if you guys could explain to the audience a little bit more the difference between type 1 and type 2. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the call. Ed Gregg, you want to break that down for us?
Sure. The fundamental difference is that people with type 1 diabetes, their pancreas is not producing any insulin, and they simply need insulin from other sources to survive, whereas people with type 2 diabetes It's a mixture of the body not using insulin efficiently, and then over time not secreting as much insulin.
And again, why is it more pervasive among the young, particularly among children, that is type 1?
Well, this is type 1 diabetes is in part an autoimmune response, and this is whereas type 2 diabetes has a number of different causes, but obesity and the weight gain over the course of life has more of an impact upon the development of insulin resistance or the reduction in the body's ability to use insulin efficiently.
Professor Seligman or Earl, anything you want to add here? Either of you? No? Okay, then we'll go to more calls, and we'll go to Mountain View. We'll go to Cupertino. Brooke, good morning.
Hi, good morning. A couple years back, I watched a documentary about the eating habits of Native Americans in New Mexico, Arizona area, and it talked about when the Europeans came over, they introduced corn, and how after that, the obesity and the diabetes, all that just kind of exploded. And I'm wondering, nowadays, we have high fructose corn syrup in everything. I mean, just our day-to-day food stuff has some kind of corn-type product in it. And I'm wondering if there's any science or research into the possibility of corn being a problem and causing a lot of these, early diabetes-type issues.
It's a good question. And Hillary Seligman nodding your head, huh?
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of epidemiologic data that suggests it is the changes in our diet over the last 20 years that have contributed substantially to the obesity epidemic, which in turn has been the most important risk for the diabetes.
Particularly
epidemic.
All the fast food, which is high fructose and corn syrup.
Right, right. And corn syrup is probably a big part of this, although we don't know whether it is corn syrup in and of itself or it is just that we are eating all these very high sugar, very highly processed foods. We don't actually know what it is about our modern diet which is predisposing us to obesity, but it is very clear that it is our modern diet, the highly processed foods in association with our sedentary lifestyle, that are really driving this epidemiologic change.
Well, Ed Gregg, you study these different ethnic groups. For example, is there much of a link in diet with specifically that we know with Native Americans, with African Americans? I mean, how much of a connection is it to the kind of diet that is characteristic of those particular groups?
Well, it appears to make a difference in those groups, but it appears to make a difference in all the groups. But as was just mentioned, really, what isn't clear is whether it's above and beyond, whether different types of the changes in our diet has affected our diabetes risk because it's made us more obese or whether it's had independent effects above and beyond that. One thing that we have seen is that a lean person today is no more likely to have diabetes than a lean person 20 years ago. So in other words, the shifts that we've seen in diabetes really does seem to depend upon the increase in overweight and obesity that we've seen. But that said, high fructose corn syrups could be a factor affecting our levels of obesity. So that would be one of the an underlying thing to consider changing in the environment.
Since Karen Earl mentioned that I'm a diabetic, it's amazing if people have come up and said that they are, or let me show you my pump, that kind of thing. in fact, when is it that somebody actually requires something like a pump?
Great question. So with type 1 diabetes, you tend to need insulin from the beginning. And as was mentioned earlier, type 1, it's the one where your pancreas no longer makes any insulin. You need insulin. It tends to happen more often in kids, but actually any time through the life cycle, you can get type 1 diabetes. So I diagnose people in their 40s, 50s, 60s with type 1 diabetes on a regular basis. Those patients need insulin from the get-go. The question about turning to an insulin pump, it's really a different way to deliver insulin. So it's still using insulin, but instead of having two injections four times a day, you get a continuous infusion of insulin. That's really more of a lifestyle or personal choice. In terms of type 2 diabetics, often they need insulin as well. So once they've had diabetes 10, 20, 30 years, often the pancreas stops producing insulin. They often need to do multiple insulin injections and actually can also benefit from a continuous infusion of a pump as well.
And from San Francisco, Tanya, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My dad is a diabetic, and he's on a slew of medications to try to keep it under control. And I've noticed since he's been on the medication, he's become quite complacent in trying to keep his diet under control and exercising. I'm wondering if any studies have been done in that regard, and also how effective are drugs alone with regard to keeping the risk factors alone, or keeping the risk factors under control?
Yeah, Karen Earle.
It's a good question because medications actually work much better in association with diet and exercise and other lifestyle interventions. Certainly, they can be effective on their own, but we encourage people to do all the things that they can do to improve their diabetes, to prevent higher doses of medications and multiple medications.
Got a whole bunch of emails here that I want to go to, and then we'll go to more of your calls, at least some of these emails. Here's a listener, Melanie. Thank you for this excellent program. Thank you, Melanie. She says, given the enormous positive impact of breastfeeding on diabetes prevention, could you discuss this on air? The beneficial results of breastfeeding are well documented in research literature.
There have been some studies linking breastfeeding to prevention of type 1 diabetes in terms of the autoimmune disease. So that would really be preventing type 1, which, as we mentioned, is not the biggest factor in our increasing rates of diabetes overall.
There's a listener who says, want to add the diabetes care being such a major contributor to healthcare costs. We should also acknowledge the fabulous work done by public health departments in the Bay Area, changing the social and economic environment to prevent the onset of diabetes. These interventions include making fresh fruits and vegetables available through farmers markets, making streets safer for pedestrians and cyclists, physical activity, programming at school and community level, healthier snack options in schools, and supporting public recreation programs. All of the above aimed at communities costs a fraction of the burden for treating diabetes patients. And Charles writes, my blood sugar is almost always higher in the morning than when I go to bed at night, so my levels may be normal at night and high in the morning. I've heard this is common, but how does that affect the level that indicates diabetes? Hillary Seligman?
It's unclear whether your caller is already being treated for diabetes or not. If you're being treated for diabetes, that's something to bring up with your physician, and a change in your medication doses is something that usually can take care of that, or taking your medication at a different time of day is something that can take care of that.
There's another listener, Margaret, who says, your guest mentioned that A1C is a test used for diabetics but not pre-diabetics. Why is it not used for pre-diabetics?
The hemoglobin A1C is not used as a screening test because the tests can be falsely low or falsely high under certain situations. And so in general, we use for screening tests either a fasting blood sugar or under certain situations, what we call a two-hour glucose tolerance test, where the physician will have you drink a glucose drink, which is a very sugary drink, and then 2 hours later check your blood sugar. That's particularly done in pregnant women, but in some other people as well. Those are the ways that we diagnose diabetes, and I should say also that a diagnosis of diabetes requires that you have an elevated blood sugar on multiple occasions. So it's not a single value that gives you a diagnosis of diabetes. It does need to be repeated.
I wondered how strict you have to be with, you know, some of those fasts, they say 10 hours, and, you know, what if it's only you fudge and you get 8 hours or whatever, you know, I mean, it's somewhat flexible, it seems, isn't it?
It's somewhat flexible. I think if you're 6 or 8 hours out, then your body is pretty much returned to a steady state in terms of your glucose level, and that's what you want in terms of doing the screening test.
There's a listener named David who says, my wife was killed by a driver who apparently failed to check his blood sugar prior to driving. A poll on a diabetes website notes more than half of diabetics don't ever or rarely test prior to driving. Is there anything being done to change this, and how can one help raise consciousness?
Probably the driver with diabetes had hypoglycemia, which is a low blood sugar, which can decrease your response time and even put you into a coma if it goes untreated. I encourage all of my patients on insulin to check their blood sugar before they drive to prevent some accident like that. In fact, if a diabetic has had some sort of motor vehicle accident, they can have their driver's license suspended until they get a note from their doctor saying their diabetes is under better control. But I think the real solution is just awareness among doctors and patients about the importance of that blood sugar check before you get behind the wheel.
What do we know about the effect of stress on blood sugar?
Stress actually can increase blood sugar in most circumstances. So whenever your body is stressed, which would be an illness or infection or physical or emotional stress, the blood sugars tend to go high.
Another listener, Frank, says, what are the good fats and bad fats with respect to diabetes, and what are the good carbs and bad carbs with respect? And he wants to know my diet and exercise routine, but we'll leave that off the air for now. But go ahead, Hillary Seligman.
Well, you know, in terms of fats, first of all, the simple answer to your question is without people having to make very complicated changes in their diet, the easiest way to reduce fats and carbohydrates is to reduce your portion size. And I say this in particular for people who for whom the nuances of a diabetic diet are difficult, and also for people who have a difficult time affording to change their diet. As we know, fruits and vegetables are much more expensive calorie for calorie than a lot of the other foods that we eat. So I think portion control is the simplest, easiest way to reduce fats and carbohydrates in your diet.
Do we know anything, Ed Gregg, about portion control in this upswing in diabetes?
Well, we have seen data showing increases in portion sizes over the last decade, clearly, particularly in the foods that we get when we eat out.
Supersize me, you mean?
That's right.
And again, this is all across the board, all Caucasians as well as the ethnic groups that have rises in diabetes numbers. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. I think the best advice, Frank wants to know my routine. The best advice I can give is sort of what I was saying before about avoiding, but also trying to eat a good balanced diet and ramping up exercise. I mean, exercise is kind of the golden pill here, isn't it?
It is. And not only – you have to remember, if you're just starting out, that exercise is more important than weight loss in terms of decreasing your risk of going on from prediabetes to diabetes, and in terms of controlling your diabetes, exercise is really important. So for people who are very sedentary, it often seems an insurmountable climb to start exercising 30 minutes five times a week, which is what our current recommendations are. I very much encourage patients to make very small exercise changes at first so that they can start building exercise into their daily routine. So 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day sometimes is all you can do at the beginning, and I think that's fine. The important thing is that you make these changes something that you're going to be able to continue, that this is a long-term change and not something that you're able to only sustain for, you know, a week or two.
I think it's also, like I said, important to kind of, if you are exercising, and I was walking pretty regularly at a brisk pace, trying to walk about 4 miles, 4 or 5 times a week, to ramp it up, to climb more hills, to, you know, walk longer if possible, and so forth. Fletcher, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My grandmother had diabetes, and I've always wondered if I was at risk. I think my body's always done a poor job of processing my food, that my blood sugar levels go up and down. I get very hungry and tired and headachy and weak when I don't eat every 2 to 3 hours. I'm 53 years old now. I'm in excellent shape. I have a very good diet, but it feels like it's getting worse. Like, my blood sugar levels are becoming less and less well-regulated by my system. Is there anything I can do? Does that mean I'm pre-diabetic, or what can I do about this? My doctors tell me there's nothing wrong with me.
Any response from either of our doctors in studio, Hillary Seligman, Karen Earle?
Well, I don't know what his fasting blood sugars are, but assuming they're normal, he probably does not have diabetes. But I tell people that have similar symptoms that, you know, when you do have some abnormality in the way you process sugars, sometimes you do tend to feel those swings in blood sugars, both highs after meal and lows 2 to 3 hours after the meal, more strongly.
And I thank you for the call. He said his grandmother had diabetes. When do you know genetically if you're predisposed? I mean, one grandmother would make you predisposed to, like, what extent? Or how does one quantify that? Or does one?
I don't know if there's a number off the top of my head.
There's nothing formulaic.
There's nothing formulaic. The more relatives you have with diabetes, certainly the higher your risk is. Someone with multiple relatives who have diabetes should be more aggressive about finding a way into the physician's office to get screened. That being said, a single family member, particularly a close family member with diabetes, particularly if you're overweight or obese, should be a real call to get into the doctor's office and get fasting blood sugar done. I should also say that if you don't, for some reason, have access to a physician's office, there are a number of health fairs around the city and around the Bay Area that go on, you know, every couple of months. And at a lot of these health fairs, they will offer blood sugar checks. Also at people's work, a lot of employees have health fairs. Take that as an opportunity to go and get your blood sugar checked, perhaps even if you don't have risk factors, if you have that opportunity.
You see them at malls all the time, you know. know, we'll test your cholesterol and your diabetes for you. Are these generally reliable and accurate?
No. Well, you know, generally when you go to the mall, you aren't fasting, so it's not the most reliable way, and you would never get a diagnosis from that. But it will serve as a wake-up call for you if your numbers are high that you really need to go to your physician and get yourself screened.
And we'll go to more of our callers. Suzanne, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to stress the importance of diabetic teaching and education while people are in the hospital. I work at a hospital in Berkeley, a large hospital, and there's no diabetic nurse educator. There was a long time ago, but because of lack of money, we don't have one anymore. We frequently send people home with maybe a nurse rushing in and giving them a 20-minute talk on blood sugar, and then they go home. They frequently come back again.
Well, again, thank you for that, because it reinforces what sort of underlies this whole program, the importance of education and the importance of an ongoing education for those who are predisposed or those just generally who are concerned about the possibility of being diabetic. Let me get another caller on. Susan, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the medical professionals might comment on the severe shortage of school nurses in California, of 2,700 students per nurse in California, and what they perceive as the appropriate solution for addressing the needs of children with type 1 diabetes who need assistance with administration of insulin while at school.
Some thoughts on that, Karen Earle?
Well, the American Diabetes Association here in California actually just had a legal suit recently with the school district trying to come up with some solutions to this problem, because, of course, our kids with diabetes should get the same education as everyone else, but they do need help managing their diabetes. Most kids aren't able to do the decisions that need to be done in terms of how much insulin to take without some assistance. And realistically, it's impossible for the parents to be there all the time. So I think more education of teachers, particularly the teachers with the students in that class. I know that in our diabetes center, we are willing to go educate teachers and principals and anyone in the school about diabetes, because, you know, obviously having a nurse in every school would be ideal, but that's just not possible at this time.
And I thank Susan for her call, and let's get some more of you on here. This is Harold. Harold, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Great show, as usual. I would like to see if anybody on the panel could address the link between sleep deprivation, lack of rest, and high blood sugar and diabetes.
Dr. Seligman?
I have not seen any studies particularly on lack of rest and diabetes. There has been some very compelling recent research looking at the degree of restfulness and obesity, and certainly obesity has been linked to poor sleep hygiene, is what we call it. And so to the extent that the diabetes epidemic is being driven by obesity, yes, poor sleep could be driving it. I will also say that if you are obese and have difficulty sleeping because you are having trouble breathing at night, or because you have significant snoring that's waking you up at night, this is also a real reason to go and see your doctor, because this is also something that can be treated and can prevent a lot of long-term health effects.
Have you turned up anything along these lines, Ed Gray? About sleep deprivation and diabetes?
No, I agree that there is a literature in of epidemiologists have been examining whether sleep deprivation is one factor that contributes to obesity, and if that were the case, then of course it would potentially contribute to diabetes indirectly as well. But I'm not aware of a consistent consensus on this yet.
Here's Tamara, who sends an email that says, thank you for addressing this important topic. Please encourage doctors and the press to distinguish clearly the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes in all publications and discussions. I have two children with type 1 diagnosed at ages 3 and 6. Increasingly, I encounter people assuming that they are fat and lazy. They are neither. They just need drugs or a better diet. They can be cured with gastric bypass surgery, etc. Right or wrong, there's an element of blame and shame that goes along with type 2. My kids don't deserve this. Another listener, Sue, writes, please clarify whether it is at all helpful to limit healthy fats for those who are normal weight and might be a genetic risk for diabetes but are not yet pre-diabetic. Karen Earle?
If you're normal weight, I don't necessarily think that you need to limit healthy fat. So when we think of healthy fats, we think more of olive oil, avocados, things that contain fat but aren't linked as closely to the bad effects of fat. So I would say probably not.
There was a recent show on gastric bypass in 60 Minutes about the relationship between that and cures it. What do we know about that in diabetes?
But gastric bypass is really amazing because they've, you know, they call it a cure for diabetes, which is a little bit of an overstatement. But certainly most patients with diabetes will have improvements in their diabetes even before they begin to lose all the weight. And I think it's that there's some, you know, hormones. These are, you know, proteins that are secreted into the blood from the GI tract that are really important in your sensation of feeling full and the secretion of insulin that get changed when you do the gastric bypass. So there's a lot of exciting research about that.
Again, Karen Earle is Medical Director of Center for Diabetes Services with the California Pacific Medical Center. And Ann joins us next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Am I on the air?
You are.
Hi. I am a type 1 diabetic, and I participated in Ironman Wisconsin this year with 11 other diabetics. And
good for you.
Thanks. And I live in San Francisco, and part of the process they were doing during this, they were filming a documentary, which will be out sometime early next year, and our whole point was to encourage those with diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, and even people without diabetes, to make exercise a part of their lives. And so I just wanted to share that. It's called Triabetes. And as part of that, we went to an exercise training camp for diabetics. It's called Diabetes Training Camp, and it's run by an endocrinologist, Matt Corcoran. And it's his whole focus is to show diabetics how to incorporate exercise into their lives in a safe way and to get over some of the fears that, people may have with that.
Well, and congratulations. You are a bona fide Iron Woman then. Right?
Yeah, I guess so. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with people. And Triabetes is an organization that is helping type 1 and type 2 athletes compete in triathlons and to live more active lives. So
thanks for giving that information, Ann. Good to hear from you this morning. And good to have had our guests here giving us this good public service education about diabetes, which I'm grateful for, and I know our listeners are as well. It's been certainly most informative. I want to thank Karen Earle here with us in studio, again, who's medical director for the Center for Diabetes Services with the California Pacific Medical Center and chief of endocrinology at the CPMC and president of the San Francisco American Diabetes Association. Thank you, Karen Earle.
Thank you.
Thanks to you, Hillary Seligman, for being with us, assistant professor of medicine at UCSF and San Francisco General Hospital.
Thank you.
And to Ed Gregg, who joined us from Atlanta, who is chief of epidemiology at the CDC's Division of Diabetes Translation. Thanks, Ed Gregg.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, our listeners and our callers, and another hour of forum coming your way. We're going to talk about the Inquisition in the hour ahead with Jonathan Kirsch, who's written a book about it. Not necessarily any relationship between these 2 hours, but also the connection between the Inquisition and modern history, which he makes the case for in his book. I hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.